Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. We have a fascinating guest today. We'll hear from Dr. Nate Bergman. And Dr. Bergman is doing some amazing work in the areas of brain science and Alzheimer's disease. As many of you know, the subject of cognition, exercise, and cognitive decline are real areas of interest to the Not Old Better Show audience. And Dr. Bergman has an unmatched expertise.
Cognitive decline is frightening. I know there's a lot of forms of cognitive decline, but when you ask people typically what they're most afraid of, it's something like Alzheimer's disease or dementia, because not only are people losing their mind, but oftentimes they're aware of it.
That, of course, is our guest today, Dr. Nate Bergman, who is a nationally recognized expert on the brain, cognition, and the evolving nature of this area of medicine. Dr. Bergman's website and podcast are titled Evolving Past Alzheimer's. So please join me in welcoming via Skype to the Not Old Better Show, Dr. Nate Bergman. Well, Dr. Nate Bergman, welcome to the show.
Great to be here with you, Paul.
Thank you again for joining us. You know, as with many of my interviews, Dr. Bergman, your story has a really personal aspect to it. When you first discovered that, and this was during your medical residency, that you were becoming a little bit forgetful, and that began a concern at a rather young age, really, about the brain. So let's start there today. Tell us a little bit about that and what really happened and what got you motivated to begin this practice that you're really doing today.
Right. I was in my early mid-30s, and I was in the middle of my kind of medical training and working wild hours and having kids, and I just started having issues recalling words, and then it was, you know, like patients' records and EKGs, and I was really, really nervous, and of course, you can't really talk to anybody about this because you worried you'll lose your license. You know, you're just worried about first your own kind of survival, and then on the bigger picture, you worry you're going to hurt somebody. And it got so bad that one day I had gone to change the tires on one of our cars, and the attendant asked me for our address, and we had owned our home for a couple years at that point, and I couldn't remember our address. Like, it wasn't on the tip of my tongue. It was gone, completely gone. And I, really, really freaked out. And I left the store immediately, and I got on the phone with a neurologist I knew and said, I need, you know, brain imaging. I don't know if I have a brain tumor. I don't know what's going on. Long story short, you know, I went through a battery of tests and in the end, we discovered that there were some fairly simple lifestyle modifications that needed to be made, and, you know, some things to take, some things to do, some things not to do, and we can talk about some of those things as the interview moves forward. But within 12, 18 months, my memory had been, according to my wife, better than she had known me in the 10 years prior to that, and it was really the beginning of my learning about how this works, and also relating, being able to relate to that sort of issue of fear that people go through when they experience kind of this sense of loss of mind.
Yeah, I think when people hear brain science, when they hear the subject of Alzheimer's, it really does bring about fear. So when you say, you know, some kind of lifestyle modifications, I did read about you that your wife is a registered dietitian. I think that's really important in all of this too, because some of those modifications can come from diet and from other places. What did you focus? What did you tend to focus on right then?
Well, for us, because my wife's a dietitian, we had always ate pretty well. You know, at the hospital, you cheat because you just, you know, kind of, they say, eat when you can, drink when you can, you know, sleep when you can, that type of thing. But for the most part, we were eating better than, I'd say, probably 85-90% of the country, if not more. And for me, it was really about sleep and stress and kind of the right kinds of exercise. You know, I'd always been fairly athletic and interested in exercise, but, you know, busy with work and kids, some of these, you know, usually the things that fall by the wayside are the things that are probably best for our health, as you know, as everybody knows. So it just became sort of a matter of building those elements into our schedule, having them so, you know, we knew when I was going to do something or my wife was going to do something, and and what we're going to do with the kids at that time. And really, that's when that was sort of the beginning of our turnaround, of my turnaround.
Mm-hmm. Well, good to hear. I'm glad that that's improved for you, certainly. I know that one of the things that you focus on is this area known as functional medicine. There's also the term that's used, geriatrician. So tell my audience a little bit about the differences between a geriatrician and somebody who practices functional medicine working with older adults.
Yeah, well, a geriatrician is somebody who's classically trained typically in as a internist or family medicine doctor or perhaps a nurse practitioner, and then does extra training in care of older and more frail adults. You know, those are people that typically are worried about muscle loss and are oftentimes on many, many medications, usually very, very quite complicated folks. Medically, from a sort of a medical standpoint. So I did that. On the other side, functional medicine can be practiced by nutritionists and dietitians in some cases. Health coaches, to a certain extent, can practice with sort of a functional focus. Physicians, nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants of all specialties, naturopaths, chiropractors. So it's a much more kind of wide swath of type of clinician or somebody who's dealing with patients or clients can practice functional medicine. What functional medicine is a kind of holistic root cause investigation as to what's driving somebody's primary symptoms or what's bothering them. And in many cases, we deal with a lot of the classic chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease and autoimmune disease, in some cases cancer. So we sort of take everything and approach it from a root cause standpoint. Can we discover what the key drivers are? And then, if anything, what can be done about each one of those kind of drivers?
And one of your focus is the area of cognitive health. So can we start with a definition of cognitive health, what that really means? Tell my audience a little bit about cognitive health.
Yeah, cognitive health really starts probably in utero, the sort of the health of someone's mother at the time that they were at the time their mother was pregnant with them. You know, if mother was an alcoholic or smoked a lot or certainly did drugs, there's, you know, loads of studies on all types of congenital conditions or things that people can be born with that make them sick or impaired from an early age. Presuming that somebody had kind of a normal in utero experience and they're born in a relatively healthy environment and where there's, generally speaking, love and a fairly well-functioning family, the trajectory is that somebody's brain starts to decline around age 25, around age 40, around age 60, 65, and there's sort of this general trend towards kind of the aging brain and loss of some brain function. Now, some things actually probably improve, but some things, you know, processing speed, how quickly we can recall things, you know, going into rooms, remembering what we're there for, those things typically decline with age. But cognitive health is obtaining or keeping the level of brain ability, both in terms of processing speed and, you know, things like driving that require something called visual-spatial recognition and memory and abilities, executive function, things like short-term memory and long-term memory. So all of those are kind of aspects or domains that would be that could fall within the idea of cognitive health or the umbrella of cognitive health. So the idea of cognitive health is keeping all of those aspects of someone's cognition healthy. And well, in the best shape it can be.
Well, thank you for that. And conversely, cognitive impairment really starts the conversation, at least for today, with us around Alzheimer's. You work very closely with Alzheimer's. You write about that. You have a podcast that focuses on Alzheimer's health. Is there today a technology or a detection for some of the early diagnosis of this cognitive impairment and specifically early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease?
Yes, that's a really good question. There are many, many people, organizations, individual researchers that are after an early detection method. There are some things like retinal eye scans. There are some certain types of brain imaging, particularly SPECT image or PET imaging, a couple of different types of MRIs that are available that seem to identify changes in the brain that are consistent with Alzheimer's. But it's tricky because none of those tests are absolute identifiers of Alzheimer's. So it's still, I guess even a better question is, what do we mean when we say Alzheimer's? Because Alzheimer's probably isn't just one thing. It's sort of a mix of many, many things. So depending on what you're looking for, there are some technologies that will suggest the possibility of a coming diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Probably the best tests that we have now are brain imaging, so PET scans, and MRIs of the brain. If somebody wants to subject themselves to a lumbar puncture or a spinal tap, so-called, that's also a fairly good test. But there isn't one definitive test that absolutely diagnoses somebody with Alzheimer's, and that's really what a lot of researchers are after right now.
Well, kind of getting back around to this idea of functional medicine, isn't some of the testing even using this holistic approach that you're now practicing, this kind of idea that you look at a lot of different factors to decide whether or not somebody might be early Alzheimer's?
Absolutely. So in functional medicine, we kind of reverse engineer it. So yeah, oftentimes people will come with some of these classic tests done, an MRI, a PET scan, a lumbar puncture, and they'll say, I have this diagnosis. What we're looking for is kind of thinking, okay, what are the drivers that we know? I mean, there's don't get me wrong, there's still a lot that's not known, but of the things that are known, blood sugar, hormone levels, exposures to toxicants, how much exercise somebody's doing, how much sleep, does somebody have sleep apnea, what's their blood pressure been, do they have any other kind of things that make them at risk for losing their mind, as it were, like not being social anymore, a variety of types of stressors, both from the past, which is interesting, things like trauma in early life and even in midlife, if somebody was abused or somebody had a very, very traumatic, let's say, I've had a couple of people that I've seen that have had been diagnosed shortly after sort of a work crisis. These are usually younger people that I see, people in their 50s and 60s that had some huge crisis in their family or in their work life, and shortly thereafter were diagnosed with an Alzheimer's. And so all these types of triggers is what we're looking for, and we're looking to measure. And then to an extent that we can do, kind of drive the ball in the other direction. And not always, but oftentimes we'll see some people improve sort of mildly, and we've had some of these kind of unbelievable, spectacular reversal cases where people aren't necessarily back to their themselves when they were 25 years old, but they have a big reversal in their symptoms, and they're much improved.
We're with Dr. Date Bergman. Dr. Bergman practices at the Cleveland Clinic, writes for the Evolving Past Alzheimer's blog and podcast, and really is an expert on the brain. It's just a pleasure to be talking to you, Dr. Bergman. You mentioned this idea of exercise, and certainly when I think of functionality and just kind of the ability to be more mobile and less restricted, I think of things like hand-eye coordination, and I think of exercise, and I think of yoga. You use this really interesting term called transforming the mind. For my audience, is there an opportunity to remain sharp through exercise, kind of transforming the mind? And what does the science say about all this?
Yeah, in fact, probably the best scientific evidence for brain health is in the realm of exercise. And because that's the case, there's more and more big government dollars, NIH type of sponsorship, looking at exercise and, things like dose, how much, which kind, which are to a large degree unanswered. But, running increases, so jogging or running, if somebody's able to, and it's safe for them to do so, can increase some of the connections in kind of the front of the brain. Aerobic exercise improves creativity. Strength training can can kind of get rid of some of these little white spots that you might see on a CAT scan or an MRI, especially in women. Yoga can increase the gray matter of the brain and seems to increase learning and memory and compassion and things like that, and sometimes to for some people can decrease the sense of fear and anxiety that they have. Tai Chi has benefits. This sort of what's kind of new to the scene, or relatively new to the scene, is high-intensity interval training. Seems to increase blood flow to the brain. Has all types of benefits. So, I once asked a neuropsychologist, somebody who's very prominent and well-known in kind of the psychiatry space and cognitive impairment space. I said, "What's the best type of exercise that you could to do?" And he said, I sort of offhand, but seriously, whatever somebody will do. I'm partial to dance. Every Sunday we go out and dance, and I just whatever's fun, whatever you like, whatever you got and do, something to get your heart rate up, so you get a little sweaty. I think that's the best exercise. And then if somebody's able to do all these things, then we can talk about, okay, what exactly is the best type and for how long and how much.
Well, let's talk a little bit about nutraceuticals and supplements. What should my audience be aware of to sort through kind of all the various things that are out there? What kinds of tips would you give my audience to really pay the right attention to get the right information about some of these products?
Yeah, so the first thing is that you can't just play around with supplements. I mean, some of these things have significant interactions. And especially if for people that are aged and are on more medications, and typically people are in their 20s and 30s, There are potential drug interactions, and those need to be identified. And I think people would do the best to look those up themselves. A lot of times, even the providers or doctors don't know about those things. So there's a great website called Natural Medicines Database. Does cost money to get access to, but oftentimes you can get access through a local library or a university library if you have access to it in your city. But in any event, to look up the interactions with medications is always a good idea. That's first off. I mean, that's just sort of safety first. Second, the quality of vitamins or nutraceuticals are absolutely not equal across the board. There is not really FDA regulations. So, you could have somebody putting on a bottle that there's 250 milligrams of magnesium when there in fact is nothing. And there really isn't anybody watchdogging that on a day-to-day basis. And there was an expose in Frontline, I think it was in 2015, kind of middle of the year 2015, where they kind of went into the shelves, one of the shelves of places like CVS and Walmart and Walgreens, and pulled some supplements off the shelf. And I think to a significant extent, a lot of the products didn't have in them what they said they had in them. So you got to really be careful about who you use, who you're buying supplements from. Amazon is certainly a great resource, but you don't really know who you're buying them from. So something might say you might think you're buying it from a reputable company, but it might be somebody has repackaged or relabeled something, and it really isn't a good way to know. So who you get the supplements from is also important, and usually that's from directly from a healthcare provider or something like that. So there are a number of high-quality supplements that can be purchased, but can only be purchased. Like a lot of these companies will only allow them to be sold by somebody who is a healthcare worker or a healthcare practitioner, like a doctor or a nurse or something like that. Does that answer your question, Paul?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thanks, Dr. Bergman. I appreciate the resource, too, of the Natural Medicines database, and we'll put up a link to that on our show notes, as well as a link to your great website, Evolving Past. I really found that website, the Evolving Past, to be rich with resources, too, and I just encourage my audience to go check out at the evolvingpast.com website, which, again, we'll put up a link. But one of the articles that I thought was that just jumped right out at me as being an important one for my audience is this also a list, this five things you can do to improve your memory and slow down or reverse Alzheimer's disease. So maybe you could just go over a couple of those things. And again, we'll refer people directly there. But tell us what's important, most important about that list.
The things that are most doable, I would say that if I had to choose the two most important things for most people, and it varies case by case, but for most people, the most important thing is exercise, and that's 1A, and 1B is diet. And those are usually well within people's control. And, you know, so, you know, I don't have to tell you and your audience, you know, far better than I, but as, you know, as people get older, obviously, they're not quite the level, typically not able to do quite the same level of intensity of exercise or activity that they might have been able to do when they're in their 20s. But there's always something. I mean, there's things people can do in their chair. There's things people can do in the pool. But exercise, and it should be vigorous. You know, we're trying to get something. So if you just sit and walk on a treadmill, yeah, that has benefits. Or you kind of walk gently around the mall. That's better than nothing. I mean, there's no question. There's a little bit of evidence that that's better than nothing. But even better than that is something that's we call moderately intense. Mm-hmm. So you can take the number 225, subtract your age, and basically take 60% of that, and that's sort of a target heart rate, assuming that you don't have a heart condition or a reason that you can't do exercise. That's a good way to kind of figure out, okay, what heart rate should I be in? So if your heart rate normally is about 70, and maybe you're, based on your age, maybe your target heart rate is something like 100. And so you can, there's a lot of machines like treadmills, or you can even just take your pulse. It's, you can just go on Google and say, how do I take my pulse, if you don't know how to take your pulse, and see, am I getting to that kind of an optimal heart rate when I'm exercising, and you can slowly work your way up. But the idea is to work your way up to something where you're breathless and panting, and it's vigorous, sweating a little bit. Eating, you know, so there's a wonderful book that just came out a couple weeks ago called Diet for the Mind. A lot of people know about the Mediterranean diet, but there's a woman named Martha Claire Morris at Rush University who published a great book with her daughter, who's a nutritionist and apparently a very talented chef. They have like 80 recipes in there. And it's essentially a modified Mediterranean diet. So these are things like, you know, cutting out processed foods, sugar. So processed foods meaning anything that comes out of a package or out of a bag, anything that doesn't come out of the ground or eats things that come out of the ground are probably best to stay away from. Why? Multiple reasons, but basically they'll spike somebody's blood sugar. When blood sugar spikes, it disrupts insulin signaling. When insulin signaling is disrupted, then you already have, you know, it's wreaking havoc in the brain. You get inflammation. You get all types of signaling things called ages or advanced glycation end products, and so it's basically just a kind of a whole toxic storm for the brain. So staying away from those types of things, trans fats. I think most people know that already. Increasing vegetables, especially leafy green vegetables, is huge. Also, drinking enough water, and assuming somebody doesn't have a big problem with incontinence, and so drinking about half or heart failure or something like that, or kidney failure that would preclude them from drinking a lot of recommended amount of water. So you want to bring about half of their weight in water. So if you weigh 150 pounds, you want to drink 75 ounces of water. And, you know, I obviously recommend trying to get that in before 5 o'clock in the evening. Otherwise, somebody's going to be up all night. So assuming it's safe, you want to eat and drink a bunch of water. And cut out processed foods and sugars. And so those things are obvious. I think there is more of a focus on eating healthy fats. Healthy fats being things like avocados and olives and olive oil, and it goes on and on the list of healthy fats and seeds and nuts, as opposed to fats from, you know, fats from meat, etc. Probably not too much red meat, and then focusing on colors. I think one thing that's interesting that everybody can get into is trying to incorporate as many colors in their food as possible every day. Try to get all the colors from the rainbow, 7 colors if possible. Sometimes it's harder to get kind of the blues and the purples, but you have cabbage and cauliflower and all types of things that you can find in all of these ranges. And I think that becomes fun for people. And then if you find a couple of good cookbooks and you like to cook, of course, that helps.
Well, Dr. Nate Bergman, thanks so much for being so generous with your time today. I know you're very busy, but these are just great answers to questions that everyone really does have. But thanks, Dr. Bergman, for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. Thanks. My thanks to our guest today, Dr. Nate Bergman, whose work at Cleveland Clinic with Alzheimer's disease patients is important and timely. Please check out evolvingpast.com to find out more about Dr. Bergman's work. As usual, we'll post links to everything, and also as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me. I'm always interested in feedback, And you can leave that at iTunes, Google Play, or send me an email at info@notoldbetter.com. That's info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all.